it would be very detrimental to the students in the school here in Kivalina.
Funding for a new school in Kivalina falls victim to the latest round of budget cuts. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 9th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, lawmakers get a lesson in giving hospitals and doctors better incentives for keeping patients healthy.
You know, the old adage, how do you herd cats? You don't try to herd them in any other way than moving the food. You know, how are they going to get compensated?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by your friends, family, and neighbors at Raven, Alaska, connecting over 100 communities across the state. Find out more at flyraven.com. Join Alaska Public Media and participate in our statewide live online social screening and chat about the film The Home Stretch, Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m. Be part of the conversation about homeless teens in our communities. More at alaskapublic.org.
On Wednesday, the Senate Finance Committee slashed more than $40 million in state dollars from the capital budget. A rural school project the state is legally obligated to complete was among the reductions. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
$7 million had been set aside for the construction of a school in Kivalina and a road to it. The state committed to building the school in 2011 as part of a long-fought education lawsuit known as the Casile case. The plaintiffs argued there was a disparity in how the legislators treated rural schools and that the state was not meeting its constitutional obligation to educate students in villages. Democrat Donnie Olson represents Kivalina and serves on the Senate Finance Committee. He opposes the cuts and worries the state may expose itself to more litigation if it backs out of funding the school.
If the state's in a position where it's got to continue to defend itself on a case, on a consent decree that's already been accepted by both plaintiffs and the defendants, we've got to reopen it. Then we're spending a lot more money and we're already in a financially strapped time.
One of the complicating factors in the project is the school's location. Kivalina is a poster child for climate change. It is on a barrier island on Kotzebue Sound, and it is experiencing steady erosion. Because the community faces relocation, the school mandated by the Casile case will be built outside of the village and requires a new road. Olson says the Senate Finance Committee is now trying to restore some of the funding for the project, but there has been resistance to paying for that road. For him, the road is needed for the state to meet its obligations in the Casile case.
You can't have a school without a road to build the school.
The cuts caught Kivalina by surprise. Millie Hawley is president of Kivalina's tribal government, and she had not heard of the cuts until reached by phone for this story. The Kivalina school funding was one of the few new capital projects included in Governor Bill Walker's budget because of the state's legal duty to pay for it.
It would be very detrimental to the students in the school here in Kivalina.
Senator Anna McKinnon, an Eagle River Republican who is in charge of the capital budget, was not available for an interview. In February, a delegation of legislators visited Kivalina as part of a trip to confront United States Interior Secretary Sally Jewell over drilling prohibitions in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Lawmakers toured the existing school, and village elders pleaded with the state and federal officials to aid the erosion-stricken village. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The state of Alaska still has not released all documents and emails related to the Alaska National Guard scandal. Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Dispatch News sued the state for the documents last October after the Parnell administration took 4 months to deny public records requests. At the time, Governor Sean Parnell was running for re-election, and media outlets argued it was important for the public to know how Parnell dealt with allegations of corruption and sexual misconduct in the Guard. A federal report in September found serious problems in the organization, including fraud, favoritism, and an overall lack of trust in Guard leadership. Assistant Attorney General Corey Mills wouldn't say exactly how many emails will be released, but she says they'll be available later this month.
So we are a few weeks behind on when we thought we would be getting those documents to the plaintiffs in the National Guard case, but we are looking at releasing those documents to the plaintiffs and having them ready no later than April 24th. Hopefully earlier, but definitely no later than the 24th.
John McKay, the attorney representing the media outlets, says the emails are just as important now as they were before the election.
I mean, there's serious underlying questions about the National Guard, the treatment of Guard members, the standing of the Guard and its reputation and performance that really needed to be addressed. And so that didn't end with the election, and neither did our interest in the documents.
McKay says the state could and should have released the emails by now. He suspects the state is trying to time their release with the publication of a report by retired Juneau Judge Patricia Collins. Collins was chosen by the Walker administration in January to investigate the allegations of sexual assault and harassment in the Guard. Walker campaigned on the issue, saying Parnell was stonewalling to keep alleged wrongdoing out of the public eye until after the election. He said he'd make the transparency of public records a higher priority in his administration. The State House Finance Committee has spent several hours this week considering the governor's Medicaid expansion bill, HB 148. A lot of that time has been focused on finding a better way to pay for healthcare services. It's called payment reform, and it's a big topic of discussion in the healthcare world right now. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The Medicaid expansion bill allows the health department to consider using payment reform as one way to control costs in the state's Medicaid program. At a hearing this week, Representative Lance Pruitt, an Anchorage Republican, wanted to know more.
I've heard and seen a lot about payment reform. There's even parts in the bill that say payment reform, but I don't have a definition from what I can tell of what does payment reform exactly mean.
It's a question a lot of people, even inside the healthcare industry, are asking right now. Health Commissioner Valerie Davidson spent several minutes answering Pruitt, but her main point was that payment reform involves reimbursing doctors based on patient outcomes instead of paying for every specific service.
Alaska is a fee-for-service state, and quite frankly, we are interested in changing that dynamic in our state. And quite frankly, we have to, and we are interested in reforming Medicaid, not just for the expansion population, but for everybody, because we don't have a choice.
At the federal level, Medicare recently announced it's also moving away from fee-for-service. And for more than 2 years, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has been funding a demonstration project at Peace Health Hospital in Ketchikan that offers a look at what medical care might look like under payment reform. Matthew Eisenhower is director of community health development at the hospital.
For the last 50 years, our healthcare delivery system have been experts in how we fix people. But by and large, we are not very good at keeping people healthy.
Eisenhower is leading the demonstration project. The hospital is spending about $700,000 a year in federal grant funding on a care coordination team. One big goal the team has is to prevent people from being readmitted to the hospital. Nurses and social workers follow up with patients who are discharged to make sure they're taking their medication. They also check with the patient to see if they have financial stress, are eating properly, and if they have transportation to get to their follow-up appointments. It's really social work, not medical care. But Eisenhower says it's essential for keeping people out of the hospital.
It may not be our fault that these are not happening in some of these communities, but I believe it needs to be part of our responsibility. And the only way that that will happen and be incentivized is through payment reform.
Eisenhower says the project has reduced the hospital's readmission rate by 45%. He's saving a lot in healthcare dollars by keeping those patients from returning to the hospital. But in the process, the hospital is losing revenue. That's why Eisenhower told lawmakers the payment system has to change.
Most healthcare providers understand what needs to happen to keep people out of the hospital. They very much understand that. Right now, there is not incentive. You know, the old adage, how do you herd cats? You don't try to herd them in any other way than moving the food. How are they going to get compensated? You can try different things, and we can work hard at it, and we can put up big lines of people, but we need to change the incentive. And the incentive right now is payment reform.
The health department is hiring a contractor to look at the types of payment reform that have worked in other states and to get a better idea of what could work in Alaska. The House Finance Committee plans to spend more time considering the Medicaid expansion bill Friday morning. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the 30th anniversary of the extreme sporting event called Arctic Man.
We start out as a barroom bet, and nine teams show up, and I'll have anywhere from 10 to 15,000 people this year watching this event.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Royal Dutch Shell announced this week a plan to purchase a major British LNG company, and statements by top executives suggest Shell may now be less committed to its future in the Alaskan Arctic. Shell CEO Ben Van Buren said at a conference yesterday the combined company would sell off assets over the next 3 years to raise $30 billion and to focus more on its core business.
We plan to undertake a portfolio review to assess which assets should stay in the enlarged group and which positions would be better owned by others.
If the deal to buy BG Group goes through, the conglomerate would be the third largest gas-producing company in the world. Business analysts say Shell's move indicates it sees a brighter business future for natural gas versus oil, and that Shell finds it cheaper to buy reserves rather than to explore and develop new ones. Van Buren says the purchase of BG will accelerate its plan to pare down to three pillars: mature cash-producing businesses, integrated gas, meaning LNG and gas-to-liquids projects, and deep-water assets.
It was, of course, always the intention over time to build a much more streamlined, much more focused company. This gives you the opportunity to do that straight away, yeah?
Shell, on its website, classifies the Arctic as a future opportunity, not included in any of those three pillars. In the company's slideshow at the conference yesterday, the Arctic is only mentioned, along with Nigeria, Iraq, and heavy oil, as a longer-term option, the category slated for review and reduction. Van Buren declined to say which assets might be sold, but he did call for a course correction.
So, yes, you will see some changes in the priorities that we have communicated or implied in recent times as well.
Shell CFO Simon Henry says the combined company would spend less on conventional exploration. The company previously committed $1 billion from that budget to resume drilling in the Chukchi Sea this summer. A Shell spokeswoman in Alaska says that plan is still proceeding. Two Arctic-bound drilling rigs are crossing the Pacific now, one on a ship that was boarded by Greenpeace protesters. The CFO told the British newspaper The Independent that if Shell is able to drill in the Arctic this year, a small number of wells would reveal the potential. He said the company won't walk away if they find good value. Shell has spent more than $5 billion so far on its offshore Alaska program. The public comment period closes today on a water rights petition from a citizen group fighting a proposed coal mine in the Chewitna watershed on the west side of Cook Inlet. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
In 2009, the Chewitna Citizens Coalition filed a series of water rights petitions to the Department of Natural Resources. They asked DNR to reserve water rights in a tributary of the Chewitna River called Middle Creek. Judy Heilman helped start the coalition, which comprises fishermen, some residents of the community of Beluga, and others. The group filed the petitions in response to a proposed coal strip mine in the watershed. Specifically, they are asking that the water in Middle Creek be saved for salmon.
That's the first mining LMU, logical mining unit, that they want to start. And it's 14 miles of salmon spawning stream, and they want to mine down 300 feet deep.
She says 15 to 20% of the silver salmon for the Chewitna River are spawned in Middle Creek. She and other opponents of the mine are concerned not only about the resource itself, but about fishermen and subsistence users who depend on it.
It's very important for Alaskans to be able to fish and fill their freezers with salmon. There's never been a salmon stream that's been restored, that's been destroyed like that.
Well, the west side of Kuckinut's still a very remote and spectacularly beautiful place, and the Chewitna watershed is unique in that it supports all five species of wild Pacific salmon.
Bob Shavelson is the director of Cook Inlet Keeper, which is partnered with the coalition.
Like everywhere around Cook Inlet, the Chinook fisheries have been getting hammered recently, and nobody has a great understanding on that, but the Chewitna River has been listed by the Department of Fish and Game as a fishery of concern for Chinook, so that's just another reason that we should protect it, because if our king salmon are hanging on by a thread right now, we need to provide everything that we can in a changing climate to make sure they have the resilience to fight back.
In 2013, Pacrim Coal LLC also filed for the water rights for Middle Creek. They plan to divert the water from the stream and mine underneath. According to DNR's Chewitna Mine webpage, it's part of a surface coal mining and export development proposal. It would be a 25-year project, producing nearly 12 million tons of coal annually. If it were constructed, the coalition says it would be the state's largest coal strip mining operation. Since the coalition and Pacrim Coal have both filed for water rights, only one will emerge with the state's approval.
I think it's important to recognize that Governor Walker came in and it was a refreshing openness that he brought, and he put together a transition team, and the fisheries transition team unanimously came up with a recommendation for what they're calling a fish first policy. And that is, when we're making management decisions around our natural resources, we should put fish first. And I can't think of a better example than Chewitna to implement that policy.
According to DNR, Pacrim Coal has made changes to their original mine proposal and has not yet submitted an updated draft. However, they are aware of the coalition's in-stream flow reservation petition. In an email response to a request for comment, Pacrim's Chewitna Coal Project Manager Dan Graham wrote, quote, "Pacrim is currently reviewing the notice and applications on file and has no further comment at this time," end quote. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
More than 9,000 people are booked for Alaska Marine Highway sailings that will likely be cut due to budget reductions. Ferry Chief Mike Newsel says about 2,500 vehicles are also scheduled for those sailings. But for now, the ferry system isn't letting travelers know.
I am reluctant to pull the trigger, cancel those runs that we've already sold tickets on, and rebook all those passengers because of the possibility that some of that service may be restored if funding is restored.
Newsel explained the situation to the state's Marine Transportation Advisory Board during a Wednesday meeting in Juneau. He said travelers will be contacted and, if possible, rescheduled as soon as it's clear how deep the cuts will be. He acknowledged some will be angry. A bill to move Alaska off of daylight savings time likely won't get a vote in the House this session. Republican Representative Bob Lynn, chair of the House State Affairs Committee, appointed a subcommittee to work on the bill after taking public testimony today, during which business representatives opposed the change. Republican Senator Anna McKinnon proposed the bill to stop Alaskans from changing their clocks twice each year, beginning in 2017, and to request a federal review of Alaska's time zones. Most of the state is on Alaska Standard Time, although a few southeast communities are on Pacific Time, and part of the Aleutian Islands are on Hawaii Time. The bill passed the Senate.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
After removing controversial texts from fourth grade classrooms, the Juneau School District has chosen a book to replace them. Last August, community members raised concerns about curriculum texts depicting Alaska Native and Native American tragedies. The texts were called distorted, inaccurate, and insensitive. As KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, the district has chosen a book that more accurately portrays the harsh reality of the boarding school experience for Alaska Natives.
Nicola Campbell is a First Nations writer from British Columbia. Her children's book, Shinchi's Canoe, depicts life in an Indian boarding school from a child's perspective. In the picture book, a character describes being punished for not understanding English. They cut her long braids and threw them away and washed her head with kerosene. Paul Berg is a former teacher and a cultural specialist at Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. He says even though Shinchi's canoe depicts a boarding school in Canada, he thinks it's accurate to what Alaska Natives experienced.
The stories, the accounts that I've heard from elders have been pretty brutal treatment during the boarding school years in Alaska. So that would not be an exaggeration.
Berg evaluated the controversial texts, which are part of the McGraw-Hill Reading Wonders program. His report on the readers was the formal complaint that led to their removal. He said the texts misrepresented the historical reality and marginalized the experiences of the victims. Shinchi's Canoe and other books the district is ordering for the classroom are interim solutions. When the superintendent decided to remove the McGraw-Hill readers, he said they'd be replaced by place-based material developed locally in partnership with Gold Belt Heritage. Berg says this takes time and involves historical research, like interviewing elders. He says the local material will depict real events and share the cultural life of the Native community. He says it would be great to have material describing Tlingit cultural ceremonies that are still part of the Native community in Southeast.
And just having an account of that, even, for example, in the reading program, would be just a good cross-cultural sharing. But also for the Native students, an affirmation in the school system of part of their lifestyle.
Ted Wilson is the district's director of teaching and learning. He says the district spent about $1,300 for 90 copies of Shinchi's Canoe, which will be distributed to fourth grade classrooms for use in small reading groups. He says McGraw-Hill plans on replacing the four readers the Juneau School District removed with new readers at no cost. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
For the first time, a Tlingit name for a peak in Juneau will be included in the Geographic Names Information System, or GNIS. This makes it possible for that name to be printed on federal maps and publications. Getting the Indigenous name officially recognized actually began as an attempt to give the point a Western moniker. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
To Lance Twitchell, the point east of Thunder Mountain has always been called
Kaxatungan. From the Tlingit perspective, nothing has really changed.
He's the assistant professor of Native languages at the University of Alaska Southeast. In Tlingit, Tach Satunjin means idle hands or hands at rest. If you looked at a topographic map, the peak had been nameless.
I think it's the Heitzelman Ridge is what would be there, and that's it.
Twitchell wasn't the only one who proposed a name for the peak to the Alaska Historical Commission. It almost became Mount Scribner, after the late John Scribner. He was a longtime Department of Transportation employee in Southeast, who died in 2005 after a hiking accident.
He had sort of an uncommon passion for the land here and the people here.
That's Mandy Malott, John Scribner's daughter. She's non-Native.
But I was adopted into the Kwashkwaquan clan out of Yakutat.
Friends of the late Scribner submitted a proposal back in 2013 to have the peak named in his honor. The commission approved it, unaware of its Tlingit name.
That proposal then was sent to the U.S. Board on Geographic Names, which also does a review process.
Jonan Thompson is the historian to the Alaska Historical Commission. She says the U.S. Board of Geographic Names added it to their list of things they would consider, but they didn't take action.
Then a proposal was submitted by Lance Twitchell.
This wasn't necessarily a counter-proposal. And it had nothing to do with the individual. It just had to do with sort of reaching a capacity of saying, you know, we can't just keep naming stuff after people when these things already have names.
After Malott found out about the peak's Indigenous name, she and her father's colleagues withdrew John Scribner's name from consideration.
Absolutely. Very quickly, we all agreed that that is the name of that mountain.
Malott says she's interested in seeing Native names being restored to the entire region. She believes her father would want that, too.
His spirit would have been right there with us, and that is to restore Indigenous place names. It's not just this one peak.
Lance Twitchell says he hopes people will learn the Native names for these landmarks.
When they see that and they drive by that mountain, they can say Tuxtetungeon and just look at it and think this is what it's been called for well over 500 years.
Tuxtetungeon will be on federal maps starting next month. In Juneau, with help from Jeremy Shea, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
People are gathered at Summit Lake for the annual Arctic Man Ski and Snow Go Classic. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, it's the 30th running of the extreme sporting event that's also Alaska's biggest tailgate party.
Arctic Man founder and organizer Howie Thies of Fairbanks is ready for a big turnout at this year's event in the Hoodoo Mountains off the Richardson Highway.
Because it's the 30th anniversary and we had snow compared to some of the other places in the state.
Arctic Man is an Alaskan rite of spring, a far cry from the humble beginning, Thies recounts.
We started out as a barroom bet, and 9 teams show up and 20, 30 people, and I'll have anywhere from 10 to 15,000 people this year watching this event from all over the U.S.
Arctic Man's main event involves skiers and snowboarders racing up and down mountains. On the way up, they're towed at high speed by partners on snow machines. Thies predicts intense competition again this year.
The Olympian who's won it, Marco Sullivan, has won it 4 times in a row. It's coming back to claim his honors. Jimmy Scott, a local young kid from Fairbanks, grew up here, started racing this race when he was 16 years old. He's coming back to claim the snowboard division. He beat a couple Olympians. So, yeah, we got some new blood. I got coming from Australia, coming from Czechoslovakia. I've got them coming from everywhere.
Other Arctic Man events include drag and snowcross races, plus endless terrain for recreation. People have died in avalanches, falls, and other mishaps during Arctic Man over the years, and Thies urges caution.
Be safe. Watch what you're doing. If you're going to drink alcohol, ladies and gentlemen, you can't drive any motorized vehicle with a key in if you've been drinking.
DUI and other arrests are a part of Arctic Man, and state troopers maintain a large presence at the event, but Thies downplays the rowdy side of things.
It's a party atmosphere, to say the least, but we're catering more to bring your kids and bring your family, have a good time.
Arctic Man's main events, the ski and snowboard races, are scheduled for Friday, but could run into the weekend depending on weather and snow conditions. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jennifer Canfield, Lisa Fu, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Shady Grove Oliver and Homer, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Earn a Master of Public Administration from the University of Alaska Southeast online on your schedule while having the structure of the classroom and the accessibility of e-learning. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS. Join Alaska Public Media and participate in our statewide live online social screening and chat about the film The Home Stretch, Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m. Be part of the conversation about homeless teens in our communities. More at alaskapublic.org. The men and women of Public Employees Local 71 keep the Hall Road and thousands more miles of Alaska highways clear of snow and sleet in winter and safe for travel in the summer. 2,500 members strong with 74 workstations across Alaska. Public Employees Local 71, working hard for Alaska, working hard for you. This message is sponsored by Public Employees Local 71.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.